Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. It seems logical that the era of proxy war would sooner or later result in a state of proxy peace when even the accomplishment of national security objectives would not guarantee Russia a respectful coexistence with its neighbors. After the 20th century Cold War, is Europe now destined for a period of cold peace? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jeffrey Roberts, Emeritus Professor of History at University College Cork. Professor Roberts, it's always a delight to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming over.
Good to be here.
Now, you wrote not so long ago that since Russia is progressively advancing on the battlefield, there is no reason for it to snatch defeat from the jaws of its army's victories. But we live in very, very ambiguous times when even sustained military victories do not guarantee, do not lead to peace negotiations or even the ending of the war, do they?
Well, I think that's precisely what I was getting at with that point. Is that, yeah, Russia is winning the war. It will win the war.
On the battlefield.
Yes. Militarily, there will be some kind of a Russian victory. But the question is, what is it going to win? What kind of peace it's going to win? And the danger is that, you know, it will win a very unstable peace or a cold peace, or that phrase you just used, a proxy peace. That would not be a good outcome of the war from Russia's point of view. That would be a failure. So, you know, Russia should, I'm sure it is, is looking beyond the military conflict, is looking to try to secure a durable peace. And thankfully, at the moment, it seems to have, in the form of the Trump administration, a partner that makes that more possible than it was in the past.
Now, before we go any further, let me ask you, over the last 3 years, was there ever a point when you personally believed that Ukraine, as a nation, with all the support that it gets from the West, may prevail militarily over Russia?
Well, you live in the West. For the last 3 years, we've been subject to a torrent of pro-Ukrainian propaganda. Day in, day out, we've been told, you know, Ukraine is winning, Russia is losing. Putin's regime is about to collapse. The latest Western military technology is going to change the course of the war. Just day in, day out, that propaganda. And in the face of that propaganda, yeah, everyone has some doubts. Sometimes, you know, I wake up in the morning thinking, am I the one who's crazy here? You know? Am I not seeing what's going on? Am I a dupe of Russian propaganda? Now, that was only like passing... of passing kind of notions, because, of course, you know, as a Russia expert, I have some idea about Russia and about the Russian armed forces, right? And what I know about...
Professor Roberts, it's not only about being an expert in Russia, but I think more generally, you know, having some basic understanding that war takes an effort and you do not fight it only on the pages of newspapers or on the screens or televisions, but, you know, you need to procure certain materials, you need to have well-trained armies. Okay. And you actually put that all in a row before rather than after you start an offensive.
Let me answer a question directly. I never had any doubts that Russia would win, precisely for the reasons you indicate, because of the power imbalance between Russia and Ukraine. Even Ukraine, with the backing of NATO, was never going to be able to prevail over Russia militarily. So even when the Ukrainians were having some successes on the battlefield, say in the autumn of 2022, I was confident that Russia would recover from those setbacks, from those defeats. And why I believed in that, because, you know, my knowledge of history, Russian military history, and Russian military history is a story of the Russian armed forces as a learning organization, yeah? Learning from mistakes, you know, adapting to the battlefield conditions, being creative, using your initiative. And that's exactly what's been happening in the Ukraine war for the past 3 years. So ultimately, I've had some passing like fancies that maybe I'm wrong, but ultimately I've always believed that Russia's victory in this war was more or less inevitable.
The legacy of the Second World War figures prominently in the sort of propaganda dispute surrounding this war. I mean, the nationalist forces and the kind of national heroes that Ukrainian elites chose to elevate, this clearly does not sit well with I think neither the Russian population nor more broadly with anyone who understands the history of the Second World War. But as far as you can tell, why do you think the Ukrainians chose to engage with their Russian neighbor in this way? Because there could have been many other ways of establishing your national identity, you know, going your own separate way, but without creating this sort of a war in Europe, do you think that was inevitable?
Well, before I answer that question, let me just say one other thing, which is that, okay, I always thought that Russia was going to win, was going to prevail militarily. But what has surprised me was how long Ukraine has kept fighting. Yeah, the resoluteness of the Ukrainian military campaign, even taking into account the Western support for that campaign. So, you know, the question is, how have they been able to sustain the war, suffering huge, such huge casualties? I don't think there's any like simple answer for that. I mean, one answer is the role of Ukrainian nationalism and the grip that extreme Ukrainian nationalists have been able to exert over Ukrainian society. I think that's part of the answer. I think another part of the answer is, the coercive measures, the ruthlessness with which the Kiev regime has pursued the war and clamped down on any opposition or any internal dissent from the war. So, I really don't have any simple answer to that question as to why it had to come to this.
Mm-hmm. But to the question that I just asked, do you think the kind of clash that we have right now between the Russians and the Ukrainians, or Russians and the West more broadly, do you think it's a conflict in and of itself, a modern conflict, or do you think it ultimately has the roots in the way the Second World War was finished, with outsourcing the security for Europe largely to the United States and, you know, leaving Europe and many European countries in a position when they are not directly in touch with the kind of resources, including military resources, they have?
No, I think it has more immediate roots now, doesn't it? I mean, it's rooted in the collapse of the USSR, the Soviet Union, the way that happened, and the creation of an independent Ukraine, very diverse Ukraine in terms of identity, and the internal conflicts within Ukraine, which were contained for a number of years after the breakup of the USSR, but which came to a head in 2014, and there were certain events that led to more extreme Ukrainian nationalists gaining complete control of the Kiev regime, and that's where the problem starts. But look, there's also something else one needs to be said here. Of course, the war was started by Russia, wasn't it? It was Putin who ordered the special military operation. Now, I know you're going to tell me, and I don't disagree, that there was provocation, and Putin had good reasons for doing what he did. But in the end, the fact that we have a military conflict, it is a function of Russian decision making, not just Ukrainian decision making.
Absolutely, I'm not disputing that. But I think before that came to that active phase, there were several junction points when Ukrainians and the West were offered other ways of solving the huge difficulties that existed between the two sides. And the West simply refused to do that. Now, the question that I have right now is why? Why do you think the West was so determined to use and perhaps abuse Ukrainian sensitivities for its own geopolitical purposes? Why do you think, what was there at stake for the West that it needed to be settled with Russia on the battlefield, or at least pushed to that point?
You're right. Your first point you made, the Ukraine war was the most avoidable war in history. I mean, there are many, many times it could have been settled politically and diplomatically. And indeed, as we know, a few weeks after the war, there was a possibility of an end to the conflict and a diplomatic settlement. I think the West's role in this was very much at peace with how it treated Russia right from the beginning of the period after the end of the Soviet Union, from the early 1990s, which was, you know, marginalizing Russia, underestimating Russia, doing everything it could to weaken Russia, not listening to its concerns, prioritizing relations with other countries in Central and Eastern Europe, and not Russia, and of course the whole business of NATO expansionism. I hate to use kind of like glib, kind of like sloganizing analysis, but you know, I'm almost inclined to say that, you know, what it comes down to is Western arrogance, Western supremacism. That's really at the heart of the way the West, Western countries, behaved in relation to Russia and in relation to the Ukraine crisis.
Now, I'm sure some of the people who watch us right now would disagree with you, because the popular trope in Kyiv and perhaps in Western Europe is that Ukraine has been defending a future of a free and democratic Europe. If we look at that not as just a propaganda line, but as a military objective, what kind of an army, in terms of size, in terms of training, in terms of weaponry, would be needed in Ukraine and in Europe to stand a viable chance against Russia?
And I don't think Ukraine itself, even with the fullest Western backing, was ever, would ever have been in a position to take on Russia militarily. That's one point. The second point is, I'd say, as of now, if there was a conventional war between Russia and Ukraine and NATO directly, then Russia would prevail in that war. I'm not saying it'd be a victory. It would prevail. Russia, during the past 3 years, has developed such like military capabilities that it is in a position where, if it had to, it could take on not just Ukraine and the West in a proxy war, but directly. But of course, were there to be a large scale direct, a conventional war between Russia and the West, Russia and NATO, it wouldn't remain a conventional war for very long. It would very quickly develop into a nuclear war. And the side that would actually use nuclear weapons, I don't think, wouldn't be Russia. It would be NATO, the NATO countries, because they would be the ones who would actually need to use, in the first instance, tactical nuclear weapons.
Mean, in this case, UK or France? Because, I mean, apparently the Americans are not ready to chip in to defend Europe.
Well, of course, which is why there won't be a Russia-NATO war anytime soon, because of course that depends on the involvement of the United States and all this. Like talking the West about, you know, British and French troops in Ukraine, it's just propaganda.
Can I ask you something
talk.
Very quickly? And I know it's a very cynical question, but nonetheless, in the beginning, Putin's rationale when he was announcing the special military operation in Ukraine, he was specifically saying that he is prepared to make that step in order to avoid a larger war. Mm. Do you think he has been successful in that? Because you're telling me that you don't think that a larger war between Russia and NATO is likely right now, precisely because some of the Western allies of Ukraine have learned their lesson. So could we see that?
That's a very interesting question, a very good point you make. And it is the paradox of the Ukraine war from the Russian point of view. Yeah, I mean, Putin launched a preventative war against Ukraine in order to avoid a bigger conflict in the future. Now, I think he miscalculated the conflict that he was actually taking on, and yeah, he didn't anticipate that it would develop into the kind of proxy war with the West that it did. So you do have a situation where the possibility of a much bigger war is still there, and to an extent, Putin himself has created that possibility. Now, I don't, but those kind of judgments can't be finalized until the current events have played themselves out.
Okay. And for the time being, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
القاهرة لها طعم خاص ما تقدرش تلاقيه في أي حتة تانية. أنا فاكر كنا نمشي في الشوارع دي نفوت للمحلات والمقاهي ودور السينما.
السلام عليكم.
اللي كان طائر من كايرو ويست إلى دمشق
غرب القاهرة.
50 سنة ومصر اتغيرت قد إيه؟ اتغير العالم وإحنا اتغيرنا.
Welcome back to World Apart with Jeffrey Roberts, Emeritus Professor of History at University College Cork. Professor Roberts, just as we were taking the break, you said that Russia needs to make sure that it wins not only the war, but it wins peace. And that's, I guess, is the hardest thing of all at this point of time. Mm. What are some of the preconditions for that? I mean, not the Russian preconditions, but... what are some of the things that need to come together in order for that to happen?
It needs to come to an end, and there needs to be some kind of stable and durable peace settlement. That's what needs to happen. Yeah, even in that context, there will be a problem of subversion and terrorism, but Russia, in those circumstances, Russia will be the stronger party. Russia will be able to deal with any of those kind of threats. So I'm not too worried about that. But the other thing the peace means is that Russia then needs to deal with threats that have been created as a result of the war itself. Yeah, the threat of militarization of European societies. You know, massive arms build up. Even talk about some states obtaining nuclear weapons. Now, a lot of that is just propaganda, rhetoric. It's just domestic politics playing out. But, it presents a possible reality. So Russia, Putin needs to address that. And the way to address that, of course, is to endeavor, as Russia has been doing for decades, to find the possibility of a common European collective security space, which can provide security for all countries in Europe, for Russia, for Ukraine, and for Western countries, which would actually, would obviate the need for this kind of like continuing
Professor Roberts, military confrontation. I think there is not a single person in the city of Moscow who would say no to that. Yeah. But do you think there are any wishes for that in the European capital? Because all we are hearing at this point of time is that they are going to build massive armies and that they are preparing for a direct conflict with Russia. First of all, I mean, even putting aside propaganda, do they have the finances, the expertise, the people, the training to pull off what they are preparing to do?
No, in the short term, no. In the long term, possibly. But look, what you're talking about is the current bunch of European political leaders, yeah? But there are other politicians, there are other movements who take a different view of this matter. And certainly that's true of the general population. There is no support in European public opinion for the kind of militarization, rearmament, and military confrontation with Russia, which is being talked up in Europe at the moment. There's no support for that. What there is support there, what there would be support for that after the end of the Ukraine war would be for measures to actually reduce the tensions, to reduce the confrontation. Yeah. So what's going on, at the surface in Europe at the moment, politically, isn't it? It's only part of the reality.
You mentioned in one of your articles that people may be supportive in favor of a larger reconstruction effort for Ukraine. Mm. What makes you believe that?
Well, I want to believe it because I think that Europe and the United States as well has moral obligations to support Ukraine economically after war for post-war reconstruction, because it's only with Western support that Ukraine has been able to fight on for 3 years and suffer this huge amount of damage. So I as I always like to say, Putin started the war, but the West continued it for its proxy war and for its support for Ukraine. So there's a moral obligation for the West to help Ukraine from to recover from war damage in financial terms, economic support, trade, whatever. But what I also say is this, is that, it's something that Russia needs to pay attention to. I mean, after the Second World War, there was this the famous Marshall Plan. Well, the whole point about the Marshall Plan was, of course, to stabilize economic conditions in Europe in order to head off the challenge of extremist political movements in Europe. And the same thing applies now. In order to stabilize the political situation in Ukraine, there needs to be a Marshall Plan for Ukraine. But a Marshall Plan for Ukraine supported by Russia as well as the West.
Well, I mean, if the West or Western Europe would want to invest in reconstructive effort in Ukraine, I don't see why the Kremlin would be objecting to that. The question is, do you see France, Britain, other countries under their current leadership committing to something like that? Yeah. You keep talking about moral obligation, but frankly, I don't see that moral obligation registering with the population.
I agree. I don't. I'd be very skeptical that Ukraine is supposedly going to join the EU. But I mean, if it happens at all, it would take years and years. It may not may happen. No, actually, what I'm concerned with actually is a more realistic possibility. A more realistic possibility is that Russia will help Ukraine to recover in the post-war Europe, because Russia has an interest in a stable Ukrainian state, and hopefully the one at some point in the future can become a friendly state again. So the question I've asked, I've asked it of Russian diplomats every opportunity I get, what is Russia going to do to help Ukraine recover from war? And there are lots of things, many things that Russia can do to aid that process.
Well, I think there would be lots of mixed reactions to that in Russia, because even within the Soviet Union, Ukraine was the largest absolute receiver of Moscow subsidies, but it never treated that kind of material assistance with appreciation or respect. Yeah, I mean, there was always a sentiment that they're somehow being robbed. So perhaps they need to be allowed to stand on their own two feet. But you bring up a very interesting point, because Marshall Plan was not only about the reconstruction, economic development, but it was also, linked to the security arrangement in Europe. And that's a very important point for Russia, and I assume for the United States too, perhaps for Western Europe as well at the moment. How do you see the future security situation around Ukraine organized? And you have written a lot about the need to provide for neutrality, but I think we will have to come up with some new definition of neutrality, because what used to come for neutrality over the last couple of years clearly didn't work well.
Well, neutrality is the wrong word, actually. It's probably like non-alignment, yeah? And in Ukraine's case, it's non-alignment with the West, non-alignment with NATO.
Military non-alignment, because as we discussed, Ukraine will still need all the help it can get in economic terms.
Yeah, and also there's also the issue of political alignment as well. But in order to sustain military de-alignment or non-alignment, there also needs to be a degree of political non-alignment as well. Yeah, but in terms of Ukraine's own particular security situation, yeah. I mean, it's perfectly legitimate for the Ukrainians to demand that if they're going to, accept neutrality or accept de-alignment with NATO, then what's going to guarantee their security in the future? So part of any end to the war and any peace settlement will be some kind of guarantee, or rather, I think, a series of guarantees of European and Ukraine's security. Because if Ukraine is giving up, to a certain extent, the power to defend itself, then it's reasonable for it to ask, who's going to guarantee our security in those circumstances?
Well, there have been some proposals coming, very unorthodox proposals coming from the United States. For example, I don't know if you heard President Trump suggesting that, for example, the Americans would want to take either ownership or control of major industrial landmarks in Ukraine, including the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. What do you think about it? Do you think Ukraine may agree to that? And Why would even Russia agree to something like that?
Well, I don't think Russia would object to foreign investment.
I don't see what I would.
In terms of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, yeah, no, I think it's a bit far-fetched that you can hand over to American control. But the obvious thing that could happen to that nuclear plant could become part of the Ukrainian energy network again. Yeah, maybe even with Ukrainian technicians running it. And there's all kinds of other ways that Russia could help Ukraine restore its energy infrastructure, because a large part of that infrastructure dates from Soviet times, and the technology and the expertise is in Russia to help Ukraine to reconstruct its energy grid, and also in other aspects of energy support that Russia could give Ukraine. You know, the oil and gas could start flowing through Ukraine again, and the Ukrainians could get fees from it, as they have been up until now. You know, Russia could do some beneficial deals for Ukraine in terms of cheap energy. Yeah, so there are all kinds of ways in which Russia can reach out to the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian people as part of a long-term project of stabilizing its relationship with Ukraine. And the more stable Russia's relationship with Ukraine is, the less scope and space there is for Western interference and meddling in Ukraine's affairs and in Russia-Ukraine relations.
Those ideas don't seem too far-fetched for me. I think I can see the Kremlin agreeing to that even eagerly at some point of time. But in order for that to happen, I think the Ukrainians need to step into their own authority and to understand that their future lies not in London or in Berlin or in Paris, but within their own boundaries. Do you hold out any hope for that?
On that point, I fundamentally agree. The Ukrainians, okay, I'm always like saying Russia should do this, Russia should do that, the West should do this. But ultimately, the Ukrainians have some fundamental choices to make about what they're going to, how they're going to respond to the possibilities that are before. Yeah, and there's some very hard choices. Yeah, and you know, ultimately, you know, does this war end? Does Ukraine recover from the war? Does it develop a new relationship with Russia? All these questions, ultimately, it's going to come down to Ukrainian choices. And okay, we have a regime at the present moment which seems completely incapable of making the right kind of choices. But again, you know, just like in Europe, you know, there are different political leaders. Yeah, there are different political attitudes, and I think the same applies to Ukraine as well. There in Ukraine, there is a potential for political movement and for political leadership, which will be able to make the right choices. Now, it's not an easy solution. No easy solutions, because of course you have all these neo-Nazis and ultra-nationalists running around the place with enormous kind of like coercive power, I suppose. So no easy choices, no easy courses of action for Ukraine. But yeah, I think I'm inclined to say ultimately Ukraine's fate is in its own hands.
Well, Professor Roberts, I guess we will have to invite you one other time to see if your predictions are correct. But for the time being, thank you very much for coming over.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.